You can kind of address some of the enormous complexity of changing systems if you focus on place. I think there is a piece in education that is about the biocultural uniqueness of the place in which you're being educated. So understanding your bioregion, how is your bioregion in which you're getting your education in health? How is it not in health? What is the impact in our immediate locality? What is the impact in the ecological system in which we're nested? But we're also nested in the education system, partly in the tourism system, but also in the regeneration of landscape.
Hello and welcome to the Coconut Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Benjamin Freud, and today's guest is Jenny Anderson. Jenny is the founder of the Really Regenerative Center. She works as a strategist, facilitator, and educator, supporting organizations and communities to create visions for the future they want together and to find the energy, will, and approaches to sustain long-term change. She is also the leader of the yearly course and cohort, The Power of Place, which is a collective learning journey in regenerative placemaking. The aim of the course is to provide a living systems and regenerative thinking approach to how we design our places so that they can become places in which humans can fulfill their potential and true roles, and all life thrives in harmony so that the places that are precious to us become places for life. Well, those who are regular listeners of the Coconut Thinking Podcast know that we really consider place as part of learning design. We also think about place in terms of its unique expression of itself, of life, and how every moment is a moment where we are enmeshed with place and all the life that is here, which makes it very difficult to think about models, which makes it very difficult to think about scaling out, which makes us think about what regenerative education could be, especially if we are considering some of the ideas that might be out there of taking regenerative education and applying this curriculum to this place and the same curriculum to another without taking into consideration that unique expression of life everywhere we go. So that really regenerative education becomes something that can't be bought off the shelf, but rather is co-created with the place in which we are. It emerges from our experience in that place. I could go off here for a while, but I think you're probably more interested in listening to Jenny. So I'm going to leave space for that conversation. And please check us out, www.coconut-thinking.com. Again, that's www.coconut-thinking.com. And here is my conversation with Jenny. Well, Jenny, it's a real pleasure to have you on the Coconut Thinking Podcast. I'm really excited to continue our conversation, the one that we had, I guess it was a month back now, and to learn about some of the great work that you're doing, some of the thinking that you have, and also how your thinking has evolved over time. But I'll start off with the question that we ask all our guests, which is, who are you and what story do you want to tell?
Fabulous question. So I am a person who cares really deeply about life and about how we create the conditions conducive to life to continue on Earth as it has done for 3.8 billion years. And I am a person who is fascinated by education and who is now deeply rooted in place as the venue, or as the place, I guess, in which I'm engaging in trying to create the kind of transformative change that we need. But I'm also a girl who was born in Brixton in South London, who experienced what it was like to be in a really connected multicultural community before that was ever a word. And I guess who has also been looking for that sense of human community, again, ever since, through many different travels, through working in international development for the government of Tanzania, from the Scandinavian countries, from running a brand agency in London for many decades, working with global brands, but really getting to a point where you know, looking at corporate social responsibility, looking at sustainability strategies, I really felt that I was, and the work that I was doing was part of the increasing challenge of exceeding our planetary boundaries and really fractured and separated human systems around us. So after a lot of lengthy study, I wouldn't say I got a download, that wouldn't be the case, but I had a light bulb moment about the importance of the fractal levels of place that life works across our wonderful blue planet, and the fractals of the human systems that we've designed since Homo sapiens kind of discovered agriculture and settled in place, and how to weave those things together in pursuit of first, perhaps, repairing and restoring some of the damage that we've done to life support systems, but ideally really redesigning and realigning human systems, economic and cultural, to the principles that, of living systems that have worked for life on Earth for such a long time. And, you know, that's no small ambition, but I found for myself that you can kind of address some of the enormous complexity of changing systems if you focus on place. So yeah, that's a little bit about me. That's probably too much, actually, but that'll do for a beginning.
So let's talk about this word place that is actually quite complex and layered and quite textured in so many ways. What is place, or what are place?
Again, beautiful question. So place is very fractal in many ways, but if I think of place from a position of life and life on Earth, we can think of it as whole holistic planetary health that is comprised of the life support systems that have effectively guaranteed life on Earth. So that's air, it's water, it's our rain system, it's our soil systems, our forest systems, all of the interconnected, yeah, life support systems on Earth. But we can kind of come down from that whole planetary system to look at how life actually designs place. And then we come down to the bioregional level, and but within a bioregional level are ecoregions and ecosystems. And within those, there are food sheds and watersheds. And so from a living systems perspective, we can look anywhere around the world and see those nested systems at work. And then if we look at the human systems we've designed, you could say, again, the largest systems we have are global business systems that stretch across the scale of the planet. But we also have place-based systems like cities. Within cities, there are some cities that are really old, are multiple different villages that have come together and expanded to a metropolis over time. There are villages, there are towns, the different levels of urban environment that we have, down to the neighborhood and even the street. But there are also political management structures that we have designed. So place is a social construct called a nation state. It's also a county boundary. It's also a boundary round a national park, for example, where we're protecting and conserving and hopefully regenerating nature. So there are many different levels of place. But there's something else that I think is really important about place, and it's how we, as living humans, identify and connect to place, and how we come back to place and reconnect and re-inhabit place from a different perspective than the one that we have perhaps inhabited our places and earth with for the certainly the last decades, if not the last few hundred years, where we look at how we are as human systems connected to the life support systems that we desperately need to regenerate and care for within the context of the urban environments, the protected landscapes that we've created, the political boundaries that don't really align beautifully to our living systems that support us, and how we can reweave those two stories together to become one again.
And in a time when there is increasing migration, both in terms of economic migration, people running for more, but also migration on the more, should I say, first world or socioeconomically privileged level, of people move around the world. How do we connect with place, stay connected to place, or start connecting with new places?
It's a very contemporary and important question. I mentioned at the start, you know, I'm a girl from Brixton, but I don't live in Brixton anymore. I've lived in many different places in Sweden, in Switzerland, in France, and I live now in rural Sussex in the south of the UK. So I can speak from my own perspective, I think, is there are places that I absolutely love and have loved visiting that my heart and soul has connected to, but I'm probably never going to inhabit those places as a person, like the Daintree Rainforest in Australia, which was the first ever rainforest I ever experienced, or the Sinai Desert in Egypt, places that have really captured something of nature's beauty that you can connect to. But connecting to the places where I work and where I live is something more intentional for me. It's about wanting to play a role in the nested landscape that I live in, but also that I work in, from an ecological, economic, and cultural perspective. And everybody connects differently, I think, to place, depending on the complexity of who they are. But sometimes it's just about sitting and noticing and connecting to what is alive and what is not alive in the place that you live and work. So I was in Paris on Friday, Cligny Batignol, which was a really interesting urban development designed 20 years ago now. And that's considered to be a place that has fantastic natural biodiversity. But if I compare that to where I live, it's minuscule and tiny. But it has real vibrancy within the human system. It felt very alive because it was free of cars, free of transport. It felt humanly very alive, and I could understand why people would love to live there. It's a fantastic environment. But I think it is about really wanting to play a role in the life and the health of the places where you live and work, that depending on what your deepest interests are, and ideally across ecology, economy, and culture, where possible, but sometimes we all have a preference to work within one of those three fields. Here it's, for me, in the little village that I live called Midhurst, it's sometimes studying, you know, what are the patterns and processes by which life, non-human life and human life has passed through and inhabited this place. What impact has that human habitation had on the non-human habitation here? What have been the patterns of transport and economy that has caused this place to thrive or perhaps decline and not thrive as much in a different way? And what is the possible evolution of that place that could bring it back into a thriving, holistic whole? That's an intentional connection for me, to feel into and sense into the rhythms in this particular place that would create more life.
You mentioned early on that you were interested and passionate about education. So I'm going to jump in and maybe jump out of this, but let's jump in right now into it. One of the issues with migration when people move around is that there has to be some kind of language that's understood in terms of education, in terms of credentials, in terms of what's being done inside these schools. And so therefore a certain standardization, a certain need to compare, to find equivalence, to find ways to be able to rank people. So how do we work in this education system, which is incredibly, or increasingly, should I say, it's increasingly migratory, and we need to have this common language. That seems to be a contradiction when it comes to actually caring and about our local place, caring about the places that we inhabit. How do we resolve this tension, or how do we work with it, or how do we actually break it?
You're asking me some really challenging questions here, which is fantastic, because it's really, you know, these are really important things to think about. So, you know, in terms of the increasingly human migratory patterns that we have, and it comes to place, I do deeply think that, you know, that those are very complex issues from place to place, but on an individual level, very much about setting an intention to be part of that place. But when it comes to education, I always shiver slightly when I hear the standardization word, because I think one of the things that we have done horribly wrong in the past decades, 100 years, is treat every single place as if each of them were the same in a homogenous mass that actually negates the biocultural uniqueness of every place that exists, whether we recognize it or not. So how should we think about that in terms of education? I think there is a piece in education that is about the biocultural uniqueness of the place in which you're being educated. That is really important to weave into the curriculum. So understanding your bioregion, how is your bioregion in which you're getting your education in health? How is it not in health? How does food pass through it? Where is food produced in your bioregion? How much comes in? What is the flow of water like? Are you becoming water scarce? How should that be addressed? How should that look? What is the biodiversity like in your bioregion? So I think there is something about educating young people in particular about the bioregion in which they live in, which could be a standardization within the education system, but obviously different to the different places that we are being educated in. Then I think, you know, what young people should study is a very different question all over the world, but it's certainly probably not what they're being asked to study currently in the curriculums that I have come across in different countries that I have visited. And you'll be very familiar with that yourself. So I think there are that we need to really completely rethink education, because if we're educating young people on the subject matters that I was educated on, for example, you know, we've really already failed them, because their needs are going to be significantly different from my generation or even yours. But I think there are some common topics that, again, can be looked at internationally, but also regionally in terms of their impact. Cultural anthropology is one of those that I think is really important, the study of human societies and their cultural development in order to draw, you know, critical learning on what to do and what not to do. So the history and impact of Western colonialism, the history of Indigenous peoples, their cultural repression and renaissance, things like the history of movements, of activism and resistance, fields like racial justice and privilege, a history of minority movements and culture, And even things like the rise and fall of civilizations, I would say, are really important for everybody to understand, not perhaps just young people. And you know, I'd probably be roasted by the most academics I can think of, but I also put the history of economic models from Descartes to neoliberalism in there, development of capitalism, history of innovation and technology maybe. And then there are, you know, life is nested and relational. So the widest possible skills that relate to being in right relationship, not just with other humans, but with nature too. So, you know, people who can communicate and influence even across the widest possible range of cultures, worldviews, and environments are, you know, those are really important things. And they're not the kind of communication skills, you know, currently we have advertising professionals or political spin doctors, but they're not the kind of skills that young people trying to help deliver a regenerative future will need. You know, they need deep listening, empathy, intercultural communication, facilitation, constructive feedback skills. They'll need to really know deep inquiry methods like appreciative inquiry, art of hosting, or theory U, and they'll really need reconciling skills, not just conflict awareness, but nonviolent communication and the capacity to evolve complex paradoxes and challenges where human society has got very stuck. You know, they'll need to know how to build collaborative effort to call into being fields of energy that can withstand the rigors of transformative change. You know, things like understanding ownership, how the commons could be managed, real wisdom coming from people like Patrick Geddes, Eleanor Ostrom. Yeah, I think I'm probably ranting now and I could go on, but there are so many things that aren't woven into current curriculums that I think will be really important.
And I guess the follow-on question is, after they graduate from university or high school or whatever it might be, there's still this need to connect, and they still need to build ourselves. How do we continue to create systems and cultures that get us to connect to place by learning about place, by learning about bioregion?
You know, I think there were three kinds of really interesting stories and people that really inspired me when I was thinking about, you know, what could the future of education look like? And one I mentioned was Sir Patrick Geddes, who was an eminent ecological designer about 100 years ago. He really understood that education could play an important role as a disciplinary integrator and facilitator of cultural transformation. And that kind of culturally transformative education that can make explicit and challenge assumptions that underline the culturally dominant worldview, I think, were really important in his work. And the second person who always has really inspired me was Donella Meadows, who formed the Ballaston Group and wrote Limits to Growth such a long time ago. And she foresaw a real importance for things that she described as bioregional learning centres. That would spring up in every bioregion, possibly multiple, depending on how large each discrete bioregion would be, that would contain people with amazing minds and tools, but wouldn't be walled off like scientific centers are from the lives of ordinary people or the realities of political process. And people in those centers would be at home with, comfortable with, farmers, urban planners, heads of state, and be able to listen to and talk to all of them. And those centres would have the capacity to work on the challenges of their bioregion, consistent with the culture and the environment of that particular place. And then there was one other story that really, you know, caught my attention some time ago that was written up by a number of different people. And that was in the Nordic countries where, again, about 100 years ago, they were poor agrarian societies, and their collective governments at the time, very inspired by the German notion of Bildung, created folk centres, community centres that young people after graduation could spend 8 or 9 months in, really working on their moral compass. So I think there is a combination of those approaches that really importantly create communities of practice and communities of place in different ways that I think could be a really supportive social infrastructure for us going forwards.
I'm going to tap into your past life in Brand and ask specifically about maybe some of the things that influence people. And I want to take it from the angle of the idea of these bioregions, the places, and really thinking about logistics. So one of the things about maybe, you know, not having ecological breakdown is maybe having these bioregions where we produce, transport, and consume on a much smaller scale. The fear is, and this is what we hear in the media, is that degrowth means that we're all going to go back to living in caves and we have to give everything up and so forth. Maybe it's more about simplicity. Maybe it's more about changing these production, transportation, consumption patterns. How do we nevertheless start to work with people's current paradigms to transform those paradigms in ways that living simply actually might be something to look forward to, because again, it might help us avoid ecological breakdown. I think you understand what I'm trying to get at is how do we work with these concepts given the fact that we are taught that GDP growth, all this and accumulation of stuff is a good thing.
It was funny. I was at a conference several months ago. I was invited to be on a panel, an economic conference, and voiced the unacceptable word degrowth, which is the elephant kind of in the room. And certainly here in the UK, people may not have actually paid attention, but we've probably been in degrowth for 10 years. So it's whether we like the word or like the expression or not, it's happening anyway, for a variety of different reasons. But, you know, this is not a simple transition, but it would be good if we could look at some simplicity. So on a global scale, we are trying to think about re-regionalizing or bio-regionalizing, whatever frame of narrative you want to look at, parts of the global economy within the context of a highly technologized and a highly globalized existing economy that, you know, has worked for many people, just not for the conditions conducive to life and for many other billions of people. And if there was a key that you could put in the lock and turn off the global economic system and grow a regional system, that would be wonderful, but it doesn't work like that. So I can talk more broadly perhaps about my own experience of working regionally, and it's different in every region, what a region can produce and can self-populate. If I think about Fife, which is a county in Scotland, in One Earth terms, it's not a bioregion, but it is a region that has a distinct culture, a distinct food shed, a distinctive sort of landscape. And one of the things that many interconnected groups are looking at there is the question of having a resilient food system for the future conditions not that we know how climate change will play out or how economies will shift, but recognizing really simply that they export over 80% of the food that they produce, some of which goes overseas for processing and comes back. And the conditions of the COVID pandemic brought that to top of mind for many regions. How resilient is our economy when the tap gets turned off by unexpected occurrences like the pandemic? So in that particular region, it is about saying, well, what is it that we produce? What is it that we export, and how does that contribute to our economy currently? How do we look at the health of our citizens and their nutritional content that they are consuming at the other end of the scale? And what would it look like to transform that system to be more resilient ecologically, economically, and culturally? How might we transition that over a period of time? And in that particular territory, it's begun to happen organically. So I don't know how much you know about Scotland, but for the purposes of listeners, Scotland's a highly organized territory where a lot of land is owned by hereditary families, and much of it is divided into what we'd call private estates. And in Fife, I met with three of them that pretty much farm or manage the landscape of estates, one of whom is gifting his estate back to the people of the region, one of whom is very focused on regenerative agriculture as a shift, and another of whom is very much more focused on supporting local economy, local small businesses to grow up using the facilities he has, and experimenting with replanting heritage grain in order to support a better bread system production, of high nutritional content bread. And in across those estates grew up, particularly in one called Falkland, a place called Pillars of the Earth, which started off as somebody who wanted to grow organic vegetables, became a farm shop, but became a place for young people to come and learn about organic and regenerative farming, who then went off around the county and set up or the Kingdom of Fife, I should say. I'll get in trouble if I call it a county. Set up lots of different food enterprises, from other farm shops to food box services to restaurants that served only local and organic produce. So these things tend to grow organically to a level after which they need support from the state infrastructure to get beyond that micro or organism, if you like, level. And so some of the things that they are looking at there is, what would it look like to allow local communities to rebuild local flour mills so that the production of bread, grain, would not be exported, processed in Poland and come back as a loaf of bread in a plastic bag that is reprocessed and with not much taste or nutritional content. But you need to enable local communities to be empowered to start to do that again themselves. So you're looking at innovative finance, community governance to enable that to happen. To enable regenerative agriculture of livestock to flourish, you need local abattoirs, most of which have been shut down, for example. So over a period of time, if you have a future state that you have imagined where this Kingdom of Fife has a more regenerative and resilient food system, it will still export food because it's good for the economy. But to change the production of food, that more of it is utilized at home, with a goal of lifting at the same time the quality of nutritional content that is available at affordable prices, because most high nutritional, you know, produce is expensive, organic is expensive, regenerative food is more expensive than non. And again, you need to bring in legislation where necessary, innovative finance where needed. It's a complex, evolving system, it's a bit like, in a way, being a landscape gardener, where you have a completely bare landscape, but you can see what that garden will look like in 5 years' time once it's planted and grown and flourishing. And it's a complex adaptive system that you're working on. So it's unpredictable. You can have a plan. It won't always work according to plan. But to have a vision for a region which may be focused on food, in other regions I work on, it's linked to food and tourism, for example, which might sound heretical in the regenerative world, but there are becoming better ways to do regenerative tourism. So it's a, I don't want to use the journey word because I think it gets overused, but it is a process of being able to envision a different future for that works for more people, ideally for all, and work towards it, being able to select and pick the critical acupuncture points that will enable that change to emerge over a reasonable period of time. But it's not easy. Very few people are trained to be able to hold that multiplicity of many different layers and moving parts, most of which you actually can't see or map happening. But that is, again, one of the qualities I think that we'll need, not just in the future, but now, is that ability to look at ecological and human systems in place and see how they could evolve over time. But that's a very rural landscape, which would obviously be different when we look at what's the relationship between a landscape like that and the cities that sit in its adjacencies. That adds more complexity to the mix.
And so if resilience isn't about keeping things exactly the same, because nothing stays the same unless you have, you know, it just doesn't stay the same. It's about being able to find maybe balance or harmony based on external conditions. I'm simplifying this just to get my point across. If we think of resilience, which is still has some amount of change and transformation, if we think about that on a continuum, how do we work with that? How do we play around or dance between resilience and transformation when we imagine?
I wish I had really good answers to give you. It really depends on the unique conditions of the place that you're looking at, and the scale across the fractals of place that you want to work on. So if you are, for example, in my locality, there's quite a well-known estate called NEP, which has given itself over to a rewilding research project. So at that scale of landscape, which is, you know, a reasonable piece of land, not a whole bioregion by any means, it's looking at a particular aspect or to try to understand what is the role of rewilding in this landscape and at this small scale, and is a works as a research center and an education center for learning, and has come back to, after some years of experimenting with rewilding, to bring in agriculture at a regenerative level again. But they are looking at, you know, what is the impact in our immediate locality? What is the impact in the ecological system in which we're nested? But we're also nested in the education system, partly in the tourism system, but also in the regeneration of landscape. So that, as an example, can offer learning to many other types of landscapes all over the world that may or may not be identical and similar, but there'll be information that can be learned from that particular scale of, shall we say, prototyping and experimenting. In that particular landscape, the landscape has, in Sussex, which is where it is, has been farmed for many thousands of years. So it's an utterly transformed landscape from what it might have been 1,000 years ago. And we can't go back to that previous landscape because we haven't really documented what it even was, but it was mainly woodland. It was mainly a forested area many thousands of years ago. So that particular experiment is partially restorative, maybe rather than resilient, partially about what is the systemic impact of rewilding within an ecological landscape. Joe Brewer in Barashara in Colombia, for example, is looking at an entire ecosystem and landscape which has been very denuded and needs restorative work before it can become be back into a regenerative state. And I think that's very true with a lot of ecological systems, because most of our ecological systems have been degraded to some extent. So there's some restorative work to be done before you can leave that system in a self-regenerating state. And maybe that would take way more than what I've got left in my lifetime in some landscapes. But the ideal is to enable that those landscapes to evolve to a self-regenerating state. But we're really learning about what that is going to look like, given the human impact of the last several hundred years. When it comes to the human spirit or human economic systems, those will, so that's where I would say I might use the transformative word more than restorative to regenerative, because we do absolutely have to transform the existing economic and cultural models that we have largely exported from Western nations into different places around the world, because whilst those systems have provided many benefits to the human system, the stress that they have put on our planetary life support systems is no longer tenable. If we are to even rein in the impacts of climate change, if we are to have any kind of impact on our fresh water and ocean water systems, none of which anywhere on the planet are now without microplastics, and we have no idea what the impact of that is going to be in the long term, then we do, I think, over time have to take a more transformative approach. But that doesn't mean it's going to be quick, sharp staccato, but it is about asking really deep questions like, do we have the right kind of governance model for corporations? What is that going to look like? How are we going to transform the finance system where, you know, an average startup is looking at an exit strategy with exponential growth and profit over, you know, a very short period of time? That's not a sustainable model for our current conditions. So what does a sustainable governance model for a commercial enterprise look like in the future? What does a governance model look like for a bioregion? Bioregions don't exist in our current political landscape. In the same way that we've seen a gradual move in cities towards mayoral, concentrating more mayoral power or devolving power to regions, we need to look at an emergent ownership and governance structure for the commons to care for our life support systems, but also economically. And I think that's in its very early stages, but it is moving faster now than it has been for a long time, I think.
My last question is really wanting to find out more about the 2024 cohort of Power of Place. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, 2024 has only just begun. So we have set sail with a number of different cohort groups who are just coming together and shaping the projects that they are going to work on for this year, which is always an exciting time. We have people working at the bioregional scale. We have people working in a large urban context. We've got people looking at small landscape, village, community, range of place. But we don't know yet exactly what projects they're going to work on. We've got people from Europe. We've got people from Asia. And from South America. So we're quite an international group as ever. But I think this is the fourth year of Power of Place now, and some years we've run two a year, some years just one, depending on conditions of the world and our other work that we do. And I think certainly we're reviewing its potential and its impact in the world. We have a group of people translating it into Spanish who are going to take it into the Spanish language. We're exploring that in Thailand and Malaysia too, so that it can grow, because we're a small organization and we can't host everything. And the idea is to grow communities of practice that can take on this learning journey and host it themselves. So that will be a next step for us. But we will also probably cut this coming autumn. Also separate the story of separation, Power of Place. It has three modules: understanding place, being in right relationship, and designing transformative change. We'll still run it as a whole, but we'll also run it, those three modules independently, because there are always some people who really want to dive deep into being in right relationship. And there are people who are on the start of their journey and really want to understand how to re-inhabit place. And then there are others who are ready to strategically design a 10-year transformational project. So we'll enable people to join individual modules within the program. And that will probably start from autumn this year, depending on how busy we are, because we are still small. But definitely in 2025. So those people who want the deep dive, and I personally really crave the company of people who are in this work for the long haul, like yourself. But I also recognize that we work in the world that is, and the world that is quick, sharp, fast, staccato, and how quickly can I get up to speed? So, you know, we want to recognize the needs of the world as it is, whilst we're trying to help the world that we want to be come into being, the third horizon, if you like. So, yeah, that's what's on the cards for us. We also have our very much shorter programs, of which Beyond Polarization is one that we trialed earlier this year and was a great success, which is really helping people develop their skills as regenerative reconcilers. And I think that's becoming more and more important as society sort of polarizes more and more, with the unspoken underlying fear and scarcity mindset that is arising also in political systems. But, you know, that is will threaten our ability to cross this ontological threshold into a different mindset and way of being. That ability to take polarized position taking and evolve it, bring it together to something that can take a place or a community group or a system forwards into the future, I think will become an increasing part of our work.
Listen, thank you so much for your time, and I really appreciate you sharing all these ideas and going into all these directions. It's been so enriching.
And I really appreciate the challenging questions. I think I've burned my brain a little bit, but hopefully said something that's not too unintelligent or complex, but you never know.
This has been the Coconut Thinking Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Our website is www.coconut-thinking.com. That's www.coconut-thinking.com. And of course, for this podcast, recommend to your friends, give us a thumbs up, 5 stars, subscribe, all that good stuff. But we do look forward to your comments on LinkedIn and on the website. So until next time, have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.